For almost 2,000 years, the Catholic Church has pointed the way towards salvation through Jesus Christ. For each of us, that journey starts in darkness, as in a cave. We invite you now to join us as we seek wisdom and truth by way of faith and reason with your guides, Mark Tuttle, Timothy O'Donnell, and Joseph Tomasian. Join us in the Catholic Cave.
Welcome once again to the Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle here with Joseph Tomasian and Timothy O'Donnell. Beautiful summer day. We're sitting in here, the air conditioned. It's nice.
It is nice.
Yep. It's one of those times I like technology. You know, technology gets a bad name a lot of times. You know,
because it does a lot of bad things.
It does a lot of bad things. And, you know, there's always a danger to technology.
Can't do bad things. It's not an agent.
Tell that to ChatGPT thing.
And tell that to Heidegger, too. Heidegger had a good warning against technology as well, that technology has a tendency to enslave us, and not only that, but change the
Placate us, but change
the nature of humanity itself. I mean,
that
was Heidegger's claim, that the nature of humanity itself was at stake because of our reliance on technology. And I don't think he's too far off the mark on that.
That was Ted Kaczynski's claim too.
Yeah, it was.
Now Heidegger was not Ted Kaczynski.
Heidegger
might have been evil for a lot of reasons, and I think he wasn't evil. Yeah, exactly.
He was just a Jesuit.
No, he was just a Nazi. But, I think his evil status gets exaggerated. But anyway, his argument is this, that, you know, technology, like it or not, it changes the nature of things, right? And he looks at a river, accurate. Right? And he's coming off the Romantic movement a little bit, looking back at how the meanings of things like rivers, etc., were connected to nationality. They were connected to a lot of meaning. And
was it a blood and soil kind of thing?
Well, that's what the Romantic movement was. Yeah. So he's looking back at that and saying, you know, technology has stripped in a lot of ways nature of all of these meanings. So when you now look at the Mississippi, the Great Mississippi, and you know, you can picture the importance of the Mississippi River in American lore, you know, Huck Finn and Jim, you know, floating down the river, its connection to westward expansion, everything that the Mississippi River means, you know, when you drive into St. Louis and you see that arch there in St. Louis, there's a meaning to the Mississippi River. The technology
manifests destiny.
Yeah, the technology, honestly, the more we utilize the Mississippi as simply a mode of power for hydro energy, the more we utilize it just simply to float barges up and down with coal and it loses meaning. It loses its meaning, right? Yeah. It loses and it changes. So you expand that idea that the meanings of things change based on our utilization of them. Yeah. So how we use things changes what a thing is to a certain extent. And what happens is reciprocally, those things then change how we view ourselves. Our own role. And so the danger is that mankind becomes a technological creature in and of himself.
Yeah.
I think ChatGPT is a perfect example of this.
That
now mankind's relationship to that is simply as the programmer of it, right? Our job is to maintain it. Our job is to put
you
it in
motion. You have clearly never used it to write a letter of recommendation.
Well, I know. It's a very handy tool. No doubt. I'm not going to argue with that it's a good tool. And, but at the same time, our role changes a little bit. Now our role is to tell it kind of what to do.
Ask it.
Man. But to ask it, you need now a cadre of people to be able to maintain it.
Yeah. My only fear with AI is that it's going to reduce the capacity for critical thinking, which we are at a paucity as it is.
Yeah. Well, I also see, you know, there's a lot of effort that has to go into creating it, to keeping it up, to its upkeep, to maintaining it. Yeah. And honestly, is that necessary? I mean, do you really need, I think about the irony of this, that you probably have five You probably have five computer engineers putting together the engineering to make your letter of recommendation. Is that really efficient to create this so that you can write a letter of recommendation that you perfectly well could have written on your own,
well,
minus ChatGPT?
I won't answer that question. I will take it to its logical conclusion and then ask you a question. If we can really get to, you know, the crux of AI and have it be usable and correct 100% of the time. I think it was Elon Musk. He's doing Neuralink, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And so if I had the ability to have basically the knowledge of you know, a Google search at my will without a device in my hands, I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah. That's pretty cool. But I do think then what happens is mankind, rather than becoming the pursuer of knowledge, rather than becoming the investigator, rather than becoming the creature that is generating new scientific yeah. knowledge and exploring the universe and trying to understand nature, we become the custodians of these digital museums.
Oh, I don't know that I agree with that. What if we become super sapiens? And now we can start asking questions we didn't even know existed prior to, you know, the Neuralink biotech confluence.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, that is a possibility, but I think we also have to keep the other possibility, that danger.
Skynet?
No, the danger of just us becoming mere slaves to the technology. Not slaves in the sense that we're dependent on it, but slaves to the extent that the technology is dependent on us.
Yeah.
You know, we, rather than the robots being there serving us, we're serving the robots. And, you know, I think that's a danger we do have to keep in the back of our mind.
Oh, I've seen Terminator.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
War Games was the first one.
Taking that danger and enhancing it, you know, tenfold. But I mean, I think even on a more mundane level, you've got the danger that we do become servants to the technology that's supposed to serve us, and we can lose that relationship very quickly. Any of us that own a cell phone know this firsthand, that how much of your day is spent honestly maintaining the ability to communicate on social media, etc., versus how much actual communication are you really doing that enhances your life?
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
You know, we become slaves to it rather than it serving us.
I think the first thing we might see, though, with AI is labor displacement. I think that's what you're going to see. I think you're going to see AI, right, quickly scrapes the internet and then in clever and ingenious ways presents the answer to your question.
Right.
And what if it's wrong? That's going to bring a whole nother set. I'm glad you brought that up. That brings a whole nother set of problems. But I think it's similar to how ATM machines displace bank tellers.
Right.
And how the internet and the function operation of many applications has created a tremendous amount of scale in displace. So where AI can get initially very disruptive of the labor market is it can simply displace basic entry-level workers who would normally be employed to do certain things.
Right, and the promise behind that, you know, the promise behind that is...
Kiosks at McDonald's is another example.
But then you freed these people up for more meaningful work, right?
No.
I mean, that's at least the argument.
That's not the purpose of that. No, the purpose is...
As a capitalist,
yeah.
I think it's a great idea to save on overhead.
Yes, right. I mean, those are the reasons to do it, but what it... Well, here's kind of what's in the back of my mind. So one conference I was at, I was talking to an economist from South America, and I don't remember if it was which country it was, maybe Venezuela before the last great turmoil down there. But one of the things you face as you build out labor markets is to match workers' skills, education, competencies to the tasks you want to hire them for.
Yeah.
One of the things that has become increasingly difficult, and you see this in the U.S. when there are big contracts to bid for a new factory to come to your city or a different city. A big part of that is whether or not by locating in a particular city, they will have access to the labor market for the 500 jobs it's going to bring, the 1,000 jobs, because the manufacturing is not basic anymore. It's very advanced. So industrial jobs are, you need to be able to tap into some pretty high-skilled labor to operate your manufacturing plant. So think of like, where will they locate like new factories to build batteries for electric vehicles? That's not a kind of a middle to low level high school graduate that's going to be able to step into that labor market.
Well, on the other hand, wouldn't that encourage the local populace to
strive for more? I was just going to say not only the local populace to strive for more, but that induces states like Indiana to be competitive, to retrain and offer better education, better training, better skills.
Well, those are solutions.
So those people that were displaced as tellers by the ATM machine, now they're being retrained to be able to a lot of them were. Yeah, a lot of them are. I mean, the unemployment rate is lower now than when it was when ATMs came on. So, obviously.
I'm just saying when ATMs show up, they displaced that part of the labor pool and forced people out of those roles.
But
to fend,
were you a bank teller?
No, but I'm just saying it's a kind of a concrete example of where when you have a breakthrough technology, you're going to have an initial impact. I agree with the solutions are to better ready your labor force for that, but that takes a long time.
But I do think it happens. But here's the question, and this is the bottom line question that I think we can spend the rest of the show on. This spiraling up that we get of that as we get more technology, we need to get more educated to maintain the technology.
Better quality of life.
It also leads to, like I said, those displaced workers, then there's more impetus to try to train them to do other jobs, etc. Does that really, really improve our life? This constant growth in technology, constant growth in wealth, constant growth in prosperity, are we really better off with it? So we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, let's talk about that here on The Catholic Cave.
When a business is looking to expand, they say it's all about location, location, location. But what about when the church needs to expand? To stretch out and reach those fallen away, estranged from the faith, or those who simply have never heard the good news of the gospel of Jesus Christ. Then it's all about vocation, vocation, vocation. We need more people dedicated to the mission of serving the church, more priests, more deacons, more men and women of vowed service, and more lay workers willing to go into the fields. The harvest is rich, but the workers are few. Is God calling you to service? Pray on it, and while you're there, pray for more vocations. A simple request from your friends at Catholic Radio Indy.
Are you a still being? Maybe in motion, but not going anywhere. Maybe it's time to try being still. We help you focus on what's most important. Catholic Radio Indy.
Welcome back to The Catholic Cave. I'm Joseph Tomasi, and here with Tim O'Donnell and Mark Tuttle, and we are talking about the benefits of technology and the improvement of our lives. Guys, I lift weights with a guy, and he's, the same socioeconomic status as I am. He has, by and large, been uber successful in everything he touches, and so we're both in our mid-40s now. And one of the conversations we come back to and can't figure it out is how, caveat bracket this, I love my wife, I love my family, they give me lots of meaning, but as men, we're bored. There doesn't seem to be, what is the next mountain to conquer? What's the next academic thing, the next thing in our careers, the next thing for our lives? Because we have, by and large, every measurable quantity of what society says, we have to have in order to be successful. And yet there seems to be something missing. And so this conversation of, well, in this first world affluent country, are we really happier?
I mean, you know, we read the Little House on the Prairie books growing up with our kids. And so you see Pa Ingalls out there having to, you know, fight for existence, not just fight for the safety and health of his family, but he's literally having to fight for existence of himself, scrape that off the scrape that, but yet they seem to live very happy lives. I mean, there's aspects of it that I would sit there. I think in one episode,
or is it Hollywood romanticization?
I mean, that book, interestingly, I found out, and it diminished my enjoyment of them. It was written intentionally to be a propaganda for sort of a laissez-faire libertarian-ish type of economic viewpoint that was popular in the day. So, yeah, there's a little bit of politics behind it. But nonetheless, you know, third world people, you know, I don't know. On the one hand, there's a mass amount of misery. I've never visited India, but I hear going to India is can be a life-changing experience if you let yourself out of the little corridors that Westerners are allowed into. Right. Just to see the mass amounts of stark poverty that are sitting there right next to mass amounts of opulence.
Yeah.
And you know, I think anybody that has worked as a missionary in a second or third world country sees the same thing. They see the misery that the poverty produces, but not everybody in a third world country is miserably impoverished like that.
Right.
And so when those basic needs are met, I honestly, the stereotype says the opposite, that somebody in a third world country, if they're meeting their needs, if their basic level of subsistence is decently taken care of, supposedly they're much happier than we Westerners are often.
Yeah, there seems to be here in the United States this stark rise, an actual statistical rise in depression and anxiety, and perhaps it's, you know, because we're constantly consuming stimulus through technology, through the news and podcasts and whatnot, and we're more readily capable of hearing, you know, tragedies from news stories from every corner of the world. So that's one thought. Another thought seems to be that because our needs are not only met but exceeded, you know, we have to create these obstacles in our lives in order to live the evolutionary functions that it took 150,000 years to get to. And so, you know, we go mountain climbing with friends and we join gyms, and we create these false hardships in our lives in order to feel more human. And it seems to be with the wealthier countries, you know, you've got depression and anxiety and different mental health, autism's on the rise. I don't know what the correlation is there. And I don't think it's just the recognition of these mental health disorders. I think it's an actual rise of these mental health disorders.
Yeah. And I mean, we're talking about mental health. We're not talking necessarily about spiritual health, although I do think there's a spiritual corollary to it too. I mean, the belief in God, the growth of the Catholic Church, for crying out loud.
Yeah.
It's growing in India. It's growing in Africa. It's
Asia.
And it is decreasing in Western Europe. It's decreasing in the United States. It's decreasing in the wealthy countries.
Yeah.
And I do think there's a correlation to that.
To affluence.
To affluence. Yeah. And, you know, Jesus hinted at it, or Jesus stated it straight out. I mean, he said it's harder for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven than it is for a camel to go through the eye of a needle.
Yeah.
And you know, it's hard for us as Westerners to sit there and say, no, poverty, there's an advantage to it that's to be embraced, because that sounds ludicrous. Well, but maybe there's something to it.
I, as a kid, well, not even as a kid, I would say for a long time in my life, this understanding, and perhaps it was because it was never explained, but the correlation between the rich man not being able to enter into the kingdom of heaven is because he was somehow intrinsically evil. And what I'm learning is, no, he wasn't intrinsically evil. He was lazy, and he was placated by the stuff around him to give him comfort, that he forgot that we rely solely on God.
I guess, you know, but that's even losing the context of the statement in the Bible, because the context comes about as Jesus's comment on the faithful disciple whom Jesus loved, who turned away from God when he told him he had to sell all his riches. So the young man comes to God, says, "Master, you know, what do I have to do to inherit eternal life?" And
that he keeps the commandments.
He keeps the commandments. God goes through, and it says Jesus loved him, and he invited him to be his disciple. He said, "Then sell everything you have and follow me." And the young man went away sad. And that's when Jesus made the comment about it being harder for a rich man to enter the kingdom of God. So it's not just that he was lazy, because this obviously was not a lazy guy. Yeah. You know, I don't think Jesus's comment is apropos to somebody that's lazy or spoiled or something like that. I think there's a deeper soul sickness to a certain extent that comes about from wealth that Christ sort of recognized there.
I would call it disordered attachments. Like, you're getting your priorities wrong.
Yeah.
And it's very easy to do as you acquire things, right? And that your basic needs are met or surpassed. One of the ways I think about it is time, because everyone has the same amount of time. So that's a great equalizer. Everyone has 24 hours. When you begin to amass a certain amount of wealth or affluence or things like that, it allows you to use your time differently and not always more wisely. And so
let's be clear.
Yeah.
If you make more than $33,000, you belong to the top 1% of the world. It doesn't mean that you belong to the top 1% of the United States or Great Britain.
Right.
But when we're talking about wealth, we have an exuberant amount of wealth, an ungodly amount of wealth, more wealth than the world has ever known here in the United States. We have life for human beings has never been better as a species.
Right.
But we have a crisis in mental health and a crisis in spiritual health. And I can't help but think that the two are correlative.
And very much caused by our excessive affluence. Both caused. The question is what's causing it?
In the gospel,
In
the gospel, at least in some theological circles, the idea that rich man. Some say it was actually Luke, the author of the Gospel of Luke and Acts, who was a physician. Some say that he did go away. He was sad. He gave up all his stuff. He came back and he followed Jesus. So at least from that context, there's a happy ending for him. But what about the rest of us who live in the 1% of the world's wealth? What are we supposed to do? I mean, obviously, what the Lord is not asking us to do is to be impoverished. That's not what he's asking for, because money doesn't equal evil. Money's not the root of evil. The love of money is the root of evil.
Right. And I think that it disturbs that indifference that we're supposed to cultivate. Right. You go back. You look at like Ignatian spirituality, and at the heart of Ignatian spirituality is this idea that we are meant to love, praise, serve God, love and serve others, and anything and everything else in the world is created instrumentally to that.
Yep.
Right. So anything that we have, we're supposed to be indifferent towards.
A holy indifference.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. In other words, our cars, our jobs, our livelihoods, All of those are only useful
to the status.
All of that is only useful to the extent that it allows us to love, praise, and serve God, and love and serve others. And I think in an affluent society, that becomes harder and harder to see. And it gets and so I do think, you know, Heidegger's admonition does come into this a little bit, that we lose that focus on people. Yeah. We lose that, that focus on others around us, and we start to replace that with relationships to things, relationships to our houses, relationships to our cars, relationships to our jobs, relationships to our factories, relationships to our buildings. Mm-hmm. Those become what we're supposed to love and serve, not the people around us and not God. So I think that definitely is, I think that's a large part of it. Maybe not the whole thing, though.
Well, we can continue to explore this in as we go along. But I'm curious how there's got to be some practical ways in which we can look at these things and be able to both live in an affluent country and, you know, maintain a semblance of a faith that with at least a spiritual surety that, that we're living as God intended us to live.
Right, right. But I think that answers the spiritual side of it to a certain extent, or at least part of the spiritual. The loss of faith, the complete loss of faith, I don't think that yeah. speaks to. And I don't think it speaks to the psychological problems that we're seeing. The rise of anxiety.
I think those are easier to answer than the spiritual part.
Yeah, I think so. But even those, I mean, there's a little bit of an enigma as to why more leads to anxiety and depression. We're coming up on a break, and we'll talk a little bit more about this when we come right back here on The Catholic Cave.
You're listening to Catholic Radio Indy, converting the culture to Christ through radio, featuring 100% Catholic programming 24/7. Do your friends a favor, tell them about Catholic Radio Indy.
Hi, this is Dr. David Anders, host of Called to Communion, which is heard at 2 p.m. weekdays here on Catholic Radio Indy. A while back, while I was in Indianapolis, I had the pleasure of doing my program live from the Catholic Radio Indy studios. I can tell you firsthand the staff is small, but they work super hard to keep all five stations on the air, as well as the podcasts, streaming, phone apps, and all the other ways that you can listen. But they can't do it without your prayers and your financial support. If you are a supporter, thank you very much. If you haven't started a monthly gift yet, please consider doing it today. They really do need your support. Remember, in the Gospel of Matthew, Jesus asks us all to spread his message of salvation. Supporting ministries like Catholic Radio Indy is one very real, very concrete way that we can all do that without disrupting our busy lives. Please consider starting a monthly gift today at www.catholicradioindy.org.
The first radio station signed on back in the 1930s. And wow, people could get news without having to wait for the next day's newspaper and hear great entertainment right in their living rooms. But then in the late 40s, television came along. And since it could add visual content, well, that would probably kill off radio. But it didn't. In the 70s, satellite radio, 8-track tapes and cassettes, and the Walkman came along. Surely one of these would kill off radio. But they didn't. Now there's streaming on computers, podcasts, Alexa, and smartphones that put the world at your fingertips. And you know what? Radio is still here. In fact, a recent survey of people aged 18 and up showed that on a monthly basis, radio reached more people than television, including time-shifted TV. And for audio programming, more people than smartphones, PC, Alexa, or tablets. When you support Catholic Radio Indy, you're supporting a powerful tool that has the potential to reach over 1 million people every day with the message of salvation. If you're one of our donors, thank you very much. If you haven't joined our family of donors yet, today would be a good day to do that. Just go to CatholicRadioIndy.org and click on the donate button. That's CatholicRadioIndy.org. And thank you for your support.
Welcome back to The Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle here with Joseph Tomasi and Timothy O'Donnell. And we're talking about happiness. We're talking about the relationship, actually the negative relationship to a certain extent, between wealth and happiness.
Yeah.
And, you know, as you pointed out, honestly, by the world standards, we live in an immense amount of wealth in the United States. Now, you know, I don't think that explanation, I think, only goes so far because I think wealth is a very relative concept.
Yeah, it is.
And so,
to be sure.
So just because, you know, you make over $33,000 a year does not mean in the United States that you're wealthy by any stretch. I mean, you can live an impoverished
compared
life.
To 99% of the world.
Compared
yes.
to 99, and yeah, but I mean, once again, somebody if they've got a family of five in the United States and they're only making $33,000, they're going to be having a hard time eating. I mean,
our government will help.
Yeah. Well, that's true. Our government will step in and help, but nonetheless, I mean, there's a relative component to be taken into account with those statistics.
Right.
But the fact of the matter is, most of us do live on much more than $33,000 a year here in the United States. Most Catholics in this country are fairly well off, and you know, Jesus makes that admonition that it's harder for a rich man to go through the eye of a needle, harder for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than it is for a wealthy man to enter the kingdom of God. We Catholics try to claim that this is an easy thing, right? There's no problem with me being wealthy and no problem with me having an abundance of riches and at the same time serving God. We think these two are very, very compatible. And yet Jesus' admonition makes it sound like, no, it's not nearly as easy as you guys make it think.
Yeah.
So who's right? I mean, it really does kind of come to, is Jesus right or are we American Catholics right?
Yeah, well, there is some American exceptionalism. Perhaps we are right and Jesus is wrong, which I think any rich man who had his priorities wrong would say, I can do this,
it's
easy.
But here's the thing, there's plenty of rich men that have their priorities apparently right.
Yeah,
sure. They're good Catholic businessmen that do well. They do well for their families. They go to Mass. They serve the poor. They do all of these things. So to that extent, I mean, there's enough of them out there that it seems like that they would be making a contradiction of Jesus's words.
Sure, yeah. And so the ultimate question is, well, what do I do if I find myself in the position to, you know, both have substance and be a man of faith? What is it that I'm called to do? I think let's answer the mental health portion first and then the spiritual portion second, because that one's going to be much harder, I think. Because there isn't going to be any one way to answer that question, because everybody needs something different, and ultimately whatever it is that you're lacking is the thing that you should do in either sense. So let's break that down. What do I mean? If you find yourself with depression and anxiety, first and foremost, don't be ashamed of that. You know, you can't help it any more than anybody else can. Secondly, it's okay to seek help. You know, the thing with mental health, we use our bodies. If it gets injured, we go to the doctor. We go to a physical therapist. We take medication in order for our bodies to heal and become normalized. Likewise, we use our minds all the time as well. We should never balk at the idea of going to a doctor to seek medication and to see a mental therapist in order for us to help get us on the way to recovery, for whatever sort of mental ailment that may be, whether it's bipolar disorder or depression. Those things we have a plan for, we can do. How can you overcome those things? Well, I think the general rule of thumb is by getting outside of yourself to be altruistic, to help others, to volunteer. The more time we spend focusing on self, and this is what we do in affluent countries, the more time that you focus on self, the more depressed you're going to be. It seems, therefore, in order to move beyond these mental health disorders, it's to turn it around instead of focusing on self, to focus on other, to put the good of other first, which is love, to love. To move outside of self and put the good of other seems to be a natural remedy for some of these things, because if you do focus on your business, on your clients, on your house, on you know, so you start turning inward and you have these worries and you have the foolish notion that you're in control of anything, depression can happen very easily. And yeah. You see it, you know, with lots of business owners and lots of affluent men and women. And so get help, find somebody that you can talk to about it. And then try moving. Obviously they say exercise as well, because we're becoming more and more sedentary. So it seems like there are some easy answers for, the uptick in mental health disorders. Now, spiritual health disorder, go ahead.
I was going to say, I'm reminded of a conversation I had with an African priest that was here in the United States. And, you know, he said it drives him nuts that his parishioners will hold off with problems, right? Yeah. They'll hold back from him because they don't want to intrude on his time. And they recognize his time is precious to him. And they say, well, we know you need your... He's like, no. In Africa, we have no concept of me time. This whole idea of me time is a very strange phenomena in the United States that, you know, in Africa, we're all one big community and people are constantly coming to me. And I, you know, honestly, I need to be needed. That's my job as a priest. To be there for you. So this idea that I need my me time is just a strange American phenomenon that in Africa he didn't experience, that this idea of, honestly, yeah, very self-centered, I need my time to myself.
Yes.
Because I'm not sure he was from a third world country or a third world community necessarily, but, you know, at least in Africa where he was from, this concept of me time was non-existent.
Yeah. It's, in first world countries, we're by and large economically driven by the Protestant Reformation, where somebody's worthiness to belong to the elect was indicative by their personal wealth, which therefore increased the amount of work the individual did in order to garner more money and things, which is, you know, so you have these wealthy, affluent Protestants in the many of these industrialized countries, and you see that very clearly. And that's, of course, where we are here in the United States with this mentality to work more, work more, work more, but not too much, because I have to have a work-life balance. And so there's this false creation of this work-life balance where I work, 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 and then I go do yoga or like what I do is sit in the basement and watch TV after the kids go to bed, when really I should be spending more time with my wife. You know, and I can say, oh, I'm just burned out from the day. You know, I just need some time. But the reality is I'm awful at creating a work-life balance in a way that's natural to human people.
Right. Because humanity is naturally, by nature, we are communal creatures.
Yes.
We're meant to live and exist in community. And I think that is one of the sort of dangers of excessive wealth, is you can live an existence. You have the actual possibility of living in an existence that you're not dependent on other people. You don't need other people.
Or detached from reality.
Or detached from reality, yeah. Right. I mean, it's interesting because I remember my world history class when I was in. This is long before the World Wide Web was public. I mean, I think it existed, but it was used for military purposes only. And he said, you know, there's going to come a day where we'll be able to stay at our homes, we'll be able to work at our homes on our televisions. Yeah, yeah. He didn't connect the computers. This is all through the televisions in his mind. But and we'll be able to order anything and everything we need through the television. And you know, we won't ever have to leave our house because we'll be able to communicate enough through the television and telephone that we'll have every need we could ever need brought directly to us, and we won't need each other. And you know, he wasn't far off the mark.
Yeah.
He ascribed it to televisions rather than computers, but you know, he wasn't far off the mark at all.
And so enter social media, and which creates an entirely different reality of you know, especially for young girls. I have two daughters, two sons, and they're young enough where they're not on social media, but they're not too young as to where they don't get the effects of what an unrealistic standard would be for femininity. And I see it, even as young as they are, I see it creeping in, and it scares me to death.
Yeah, and I think that, I mean, when you talk about wealth, we're not the first wealthy civilization.
We are the wealthiest civilization.
We are the wealthiest, but we are not the first wealthy civilization to exist. I mean, you've got ancient Rome, you've got and I mean, I think China experienced the similar thing. The correlation between all of those, and you see a rise in mental illness within Roman history as well. I mean, it's not documented well, but you can see it. I think the corollary there, though, with us is image consciousness, that as you become more wealthy, reality becomes more revolving around what appears to be and appearances and image and less around the actual. And I think, you know, that's a huge difference between the first world and the third world. The third world, you know, they're not concerned with what other people necessarily think about them. Yeah. They're not concerned with appearances. They're not concerned. And certainly when you have social media, you have Facebook, you have other ways to present a persona to the world that is almost non-existent. Yeah. I think that leads to a huge amount of not only mental disorders, but spiritual disorders as well.
When you can feed any passion that you can come up with at the click of a button, any passion you might have, disordered or otherwise, can be fed into. It creates a spiritual rot, right? And that's what we see happened in the Eastern Roman Empire, where the exuberance of wealth existed after the time of Marcus Aurelius. So you have this wealth, and then morality rots. The family rots, and then the collapse of the empire.
Yeah, I think your note on family collapse, I think, is a huge part of this. Yeah. So we're going to take a break. When we come back from the break, let's talk a little bit more about that here on the Catholic Cave.
Do you like game shows? How about trivia? You're listening to Catholic Radio, so I assume you're interested in the Catholic Church. Catholic Challenge 2.0 is the newest addition to our programming lineup here on Catholic Radio Indy. A 30-minute quiz show covering almost everything Catholic. Catholic Challenge 2.0 tests your knowledge and teaches at the same time. Check it out every Thursday afternoon at 4:30 right here on Catholic Radio Indy.
Whether things really are crazier than ever, or we just have more ways to hear about it all, it can be a little overwhelming at times. When that happens, remember the Apostle Paul's words from Holy Scripture. Do not worry about anything, but in everything, by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God. And the peace of God, which surpasses all understanding, will guard your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus. Thank you for being a Catholic Radio Indy listener.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm still Timothy O'Donnell, in here with Joseph Tomasian, Mark Tuttle. And where we left off at the last segment was, we brought up family. And so what role does family play in this conversation? It seems as if the family has been under pretty relentless attack, seems to be in decline. What are the ramifications of that?
Well, leaving aside the ramifications for a minute, I think the causes of it. I think wealth and prosperity within our culture is a huge cause of family breakdown. So, I think when you get to a state in society where you can be self-sufficient, you're going to have a lot of people that tend to be self-sufficient. And so they're not going to, quote unquote, need a spouse. They're going to be able to try to pursue happiness on their own outside the context of family because they can. And when they try to pursue that, they're going to, you know, honestly, I think it's a, there's a peer pressure element to this, that once families begin to disintegrate, it accelerates as other people around. And part of it's, you know, to have a healthy marriage, you can't have it in isolation. You need good examples. You need good people around you to help bolster your family life. And minus that, you're going to wind up in a situation where when you have troubles in a marriage, you're going to be surrounded by people that aren't able to support you. You're going to be surrounded by people that aren't able to give you the advice. And so it's going to be a self-perpetuating problem. And like I said, I don't think you see that as much in poor societies, because family is much more necessary, right? There's an economic component to family that's needed.
There's a reliance.
That we just don't need that here.
We tell ourselves that.
But, you know, family becomes merely sociological.
Yeah.
And when it becomes merely sociological, it becomes disposable to a certain extent.
You know, once upon a time, you would hear stories of you know, going to grandma's house every Sunday. Didn't matter. Every single Sunday, all the cousins, aunts, and uncles, everybody's at grandma's house, right? And there was the meal. You played together, and that's just what you did on Sundays. You took time to be intentional with one another. You know, here, it's not uncommon to hear, you know, from other men, you know, the nanny takes care of the kid. The wife does her own thing. The husband, you know, works ridiculous hours. And there's no cohesion in the family because we're dynamic. We're not static. And so the marriage, doesn't get worked on. And you know, it's left in this stasis of, it seems to be good until the kids grow up and move out. And then you realize you no longer know your spouse. There's just not enough work on it. And it's compounded with men, here in the United States, because we don't have friends. We don't have people to tell us, hey, that thing that you've been talking about, I'm noticing a pattern, some data points in your behavior, and this is what I'm seeing. Because we don't feel like we can do that with other men. We don't have people to hold us accountable. Because the idea that if you're successful and you're a man, that you can't be vulnerable with somebody else, because that's a sign of weakness. That if you need somebody else, if you need a friend, it goes against this creation of individualism that we have in our lives, and it's all isolation. It's this continued turning inward.
You know, though, I don't know that this idea of the self-subsistent macho male is necessarily restricted to more wealthy Western cultures, though. I mean, that's almost a stereotype that cuts across sort of different economic levels. So if you're looking for how's prosperity related to that, I guess?
Well, prosperity compounds it. It's related because money will amplify everything you already are, and it will confirm your embedded biases, even if they're wrong. And so, and it does this, so I don't need others, I can do it on my own. Okay, you were successful, you did the thing, you have the money, you have the marriage, you have the ideal life as far as what society tells you that you have, and you're unhappy, you're depressed, you don't feel challenged, and you don't have anyone to talk to about it. And so what do? You start acting out in ways that either numb that loneliness and that depression, or you start taking risks because you feel impervious. You feel impervious to failure. And that's when you start doing dumb things with your money. You start becoming addicted to alcohol, pornography. You start flirting a little bit more with that secretary at work. It compounds loneliness, it compounds narcissism, it compounds this idea that success was built on my own.
I think it's interesting that part of what I'm hearing you describe, Joseph, is there does seem to be kind of a transvaluation that's maybe happened over the last, I don't know how long, 50 years, 75 years, something like that, where sort of like economics has supplanted morality.
Absolutely.
You know, where economics seems to be the dominant measure by which we're all being measured.
It's Hobbesian. Might makes right.
But is that a cause or is that an effect, guys? I mean, and that's kind of what I look at. You know, it's a chicken and an egg question. And we talked about family, you know, and we were looking at sort of the spiritual effects and why it is that you see this losing of faith in the Western world.
Yeah.
And I think it does go back to the breakdown of the family, which
I totally agree.
Which I think points more to this being an effect and not necessarily a cause. When you're looking at economics supplanting morality, you have a breakdown in the family. The family leads to more. I think that obviously leads to a breakdown in religion. And I think we undervalue the extent to which faith is passed on through families and not the other way around. Mary Eberstadt.
That's exactly what I was going to say. Yeah,
yeah. Her book on that is...
She's kind of got a trilogy almost on that. But
yeah, but I think she's exactly right that, mm-hmm. you know, most of our parishes put a huge emphasis on youth ministry, right? Yeah. Spending immense amounts of money, et cetera, on trying to evangelize the youth. And then when you look at it, yeah, there are conversion stories. There are youth that are able to find the faith through youth ministry or bolstered in the faith. But by and large, faithful Catholics come from faithful Catholic families. And by and large...
More in particular, so the three things that will most guarantee your success as a parent of raising your child in the faith: praying before meals, going to church, and seeing dad pray. Not mom. Yeah, not
right.
mom.
Right.
That means
dad has to be present.
Exactly.
Right? That's a vanishing quality of a
child sees dad pray, they are 75% more likely to carry their faith into adulthood.
Right.
If child sees mom pray, that number drops to 25%.
Right. So,
right. So you need them both.
You need them both. And so you need intact families. And, you know, as I said, you know, as that starts to diminish, as the faith starts to diminish, the importance of morality starts to diminish.
Yeah.
So, I think it all starts to a certain extent with that breakdown in family. And that breakdown in family, yeah, maybe that is caused, I guess, by prosperity. I mean, we were talking about, you know,
compounded, not caused.
Because now you have the compounding is when you have divorce or mom and dad live in different dwellings.
Yeah.
you have to have an economic structure in order to pay for it all, to pay for two washing machines, two dryers, two dwellings. So you've got to have, there's an economic proponent to, but I think it all goes back, and we're going to run out of time, but the breakdown of family, I think we've talked about before in the cave, but you've got to, I think the most recent phenomenon that we can look back to is, of course, the Cultural Revolution, you know, of the 60s. That's what does it. No-fault divorce, everything goes up in the air, contraception, abortion, feminism, all that stuff congealed to produce what we have now, and it's declining, you know, and if you look at the numbers, they're horrendous. When you actually look at the church in decline, the numbers are absolutely plummeting, whether it's baptism, anything you want to measure, baptisms, marriages, mass attendance, it's all headed and has been heading in the wrong direction precipitously.
Right. But I think you go back to the same cause and effect relationship there, that revolution in the 60s, which I completely agree with you, I'm not going to disagree with that at all, was that caused by a wealthy, prosperous society, or you know, is it the other way around? Is it sort of this
it enables it. It's part of the conditions that it otherwise wouldn't have.
Because you don't see that phenomenon in the third world countries.
You don't. Right? No. So affluence has to, there has to be a seed ground of affluence in order to create leisure time, in order to come to a conclusion that you know, perception of rights are being violated, in order to march on downtown for whatever reason. But so we've identified these issues, which are prevalent, which are serious, which are rot in our society, but there's really a simple answer we can do that we have, and it's going to take time and it's not going to work overnight. Men, exercise with your family. Spend time with your children. You get so little time. Spend time with your children. Go to Mass and pray. Do these hard things because that is what exactly God made you to do. That is your vocation as man, to provide, protect, procreate. And if you are not spreading your faith, if you are not showing your children by spending time with them, they will find time with somebody else. And that's the biggest challenge I think men have in this country today.
And with that, we'll wrap up our show here on The Catholic Cave. Thank you for listening. You're listening to Catholic Radio Indy.
The Catholic Cave is a production of Catholic Radio Indy. Replays of this program are available in podcast form at catholicradioindy.org. Comments about this program can be addressed to kent@catholicradioindy.org or by calling 317-870-8400. Did you miss something in this show or just want to hear it again? Podcasts of this and all our other great local programs are available 24/7 at catholicradioindy.org.